Welcome to Season 5 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast created and produced by medical students at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we explore ideas in medicine you can't always find in a textbook. From navigating medical education to exploring humanism in medicine and developing our physician identities, we hope there's something for everyone.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email, on Instagram, or on Twitter at unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. My name is Andrew Zahn. I'll be your host for today. Today, my guest is Dr. Allison Sheets to talk about medicine and search and rescue and what it's like to make time and space for passions outside of your 9-to-5 or your 7-to-7 job. And so I won't cover all of your history, Dr. Sheets, because I know you have an unusual path to medicine, and I think you can tell that story better than I can. But just a brief intro. So Dr. Sheets is an attending emergency medicine physician in Boulder, Colorado. She's also been the medical director of Rocky Mountain Rescue Group since 2006, which is an all-volunteer search and rescue organization based out of Boulder, Colorado. She's also the president of the Mountain Rescue Association and vice president of the Medical Commission with the International Commission on Alpine Rescue. So Dr. Sheets, thank you again for coming on. Really excited to have you on. I know you have an unusual path and really interesting background here, but I have a personal interest in climbing, so I have a personal interest in what you have to say. But even just when I mentioned to my listeners who you are and that you're coming on the podcast, a lot of them are excited. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Andrew, for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So can you tell us just in general, start with what is Rocky Mountain Rescue Group?
Okay. Rocky Mountain Rescue Group is a volunteer, all-volunteer search and rescue organization that works under the control of the Boulder County Sheriff's Office. We've been a group since 1947, 75 years last year. And we provide search and rescue services for the county of Boulder in Colorado. I can go on.
Who are the people that make up this group?
Well, we have approximately 70 to 75 active members at any time over, multiple decades. It has grown in the last decade or so, but that's where we've been for about the last 5 or 10 years. And we have members from all walks of life. We have, blue-collar workers. We have white-collar workers. We have medical professionals. We have engineers, plenty of those. We have rocket scientists, no neurosurgeons, but we do have several emergency physicians on our team, as well as physician's assistants, RNs, PAs, paramedics, EMTs, woofers, and some people with just first aid requirements as a minimum.
What does it take to actually become a member?
Well, it depends on the team you're joining. So our team, our team's a pretty well-established, pretty busy team, and we have a process that we've developed over the years where you apply to become a member, and we will do that every year or so. About every other year, we go and ask for a new class application, and people will apply, and we will go through those applications, review them, and sort of see who we think might be a good fit, who's got the time, who has the inclination, who seems to be likely to stick around, and also who has, the appropriate training. It's nice to have people with some climbing, backcountry, wilderness-type experience who recreate in the backcountry, because those are the people we're going to usually be called to help. And, if you have medical training, that's a bonus as well. And so we go through those applications. There's an interview process, and then they have to commit to doing several weekends of training before they're even accepted as what we call our prospectives. And then it's not over. Once you become a prospective, there's still about a year on average of training with the team before you put yourself up to be voted to become a member. So it takes a lot of commitment, takes a lot of time, and we do our best to warn people about that beforehand and hope that when we get folks that actually become members, they stick around for a long time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. you know, you're putting a lot of time and effort into training these people up to the proficiency for them to, you know, help people who are lost or injured, right? But also you want to keep each other safe when you're out there and have confidence that your teammates can, you know, do the job. What, so in terms of, you know, the capabilities of Rocky Mountain Rescue, what kind of incidents do you respond to, I guess?
Well, we are a land-based search and rescue team. We call that sort of terrestrial rescue, and we really do focus on the mountainous part of our county. But essentially, as members of the Mountain Rescue Association, I'm currently president of the Mountain Rescue Association. It's more an administrative organization of many of the search and rescue teams in the United States. As a member of the MRA, we have to pass accreditation every 5 years in certain disciplines, and that sort of demonstrates what we need to know. One of the disciplines is search, so searching for people that are lost or, you know, injured or don't return home to the or to the trailhead in time. We'll go out and look for those folks in all of the conditions in our county, which is both grassland, which we rarely get called for, but usually foothills or high alpine environments. So search is a big part of what we do. And then we also do rescue in a variety of forms. We'll do rescue on sort of low angle trails where people might sprain an ankle or fall down and, you know, bust up a leg, can't walk out themselves. We'll carry them out. And then we also do a lot of what we call our low angle rescue, which is sort of a little bit steeper, but, you know, not something where you're necessarily using ropes. And then one of our specialties is high angle rescue, where you're on really climbing terrain, sort of fifth-class climbing terrain or hard fourth class, which we have a lot of in the Front Range here in the Flatirons. And so that would be another major section of the MRA reaccreditation. And then the final one is winter time. Now, we don't really have glaciers in our area, but we're expected to be able to handle all of those same kinds of patients in a snowy or steep ice conditions, as well as do avalanche rescue. So we are also trained in both evaluating avalanche terrain when we go out to rescue or practice, and then also how to respond to an avalanche incident by finding the victim, you know, uncovering them and dealing with whatever we got. So that's a lot of it. We also do some public service education, and we are also responsible for helping out the sheriff for any sort of disasters, whether they be natural disasters or human caused. And we have had some of those floods and things of that sort.
Yeah.
So we do a lot.
It's like the whole gamut. Yeah. It just keeps going.
We can also, wow, you know, find downed aircraft, and, you know, sometimes there's personal locator beacons that people are using inappropriately, and we've been called in to sort of help track those down, which are kind of interesting problems.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, all Rocky Mountain Rescue is an all-volunteer organization. Are there any full-time positions associated with it?
No, there really isn't. And, you know, just like our, you know, application to become a member, the way we're structured is unique to our team. But there's a lot of teams in the country that are similar, especially if they're part of the Mountain Rescue Association, in that we really don't have any paid positions. Some teams will. Rocky Mountain Rescue has none. We do contract, you know, like bookkeeping and a few things like that. We will contract folks to do, and obviously we pay people to fix our trucks and do work on our buildings, and, you know, that is something that is done by professionals. But everybody who signs up to become a member of RMR is not paid or reimbursed for what they do. If we lose gear or if we, you know, drive a really long way, we may be able to get some cash. We do get some support to go to conferences and educational opportunities. So the team does try to support their members, but we do everything, including the medical direction, including all the administrative work, is done by volunteers.
Wow, that's really awesome that you can sustain an organization and all of those capabilities through just an all-volunteer capacity.
Well, volunteerism in the United States is still a pretty cool thing, and it really, I think, is an amazing thing. And I've been, you know, not everywhere in the world, but I've been all over the world, and the United States really does have an amazing volunteer ethic, and I really proud to be part of that, and makes me have hope in our the people in our country, because people do have, you know, not only the bandwidth to give their time, but the willingness to give their time to strangers or, you know, whatever community need is there. So yeah, it's really great. It's a lot of hours. It's in the tens of thousands of hours in some years. Definitely in the thousands of hours every year.
Yeah, I believe it. Is this something that, I mean, you kind of implied it, is this something that you think is a little unique to the U.S. where we have these all-volunteer organizations?
I think that is unique to the U.S., not completely so. I mean, there are teams in Europe and teams in the U.K. Where the volunteer activism is there, and including Canada, but because of other sort of externalities, they aren't able to do quite as much as we can. You know, we really started so long ago in this United States with that kind of volunteer ethic. Think of your local fire departments in rural areas. Those are almost always volunteer. That the volunteer agencies really kind of established the norms around those agencies, and, you know, other organizations came in later, government organizations, what have you, came in later and sort of put some structure around them. But really the drive was from the volunteers from the start. So I think that that makes some of the things that we do in the United States pretty unique, what kind of responsibilities and actual efforts that the volunteers put out is pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, I've never considered that before. Just comparing, you know, like you said, our volunteer fire departments, and comparing that to other countries, I hadn't considered any differences there, but that's an interesting perspective. You know, when I first reached out to you and asked you about coming on this podcast, you made the comment that, you know, your role with Rocky Mountain Rescue Group is not what pays the bills. And so I guess... How did you like come into this? What brought you to Rocky Mountain Rescue Group and stepping into the role of medical director?
Good question. It's, you know, it's a convoluted and sort of years, decades long pathway, but, you know, the search and rescue definitely doesn't pay the bills. It sort of generates the bills I have to pay, have to work for. But I came in to search and rescue. You know, most recently, I did my medical education, and, you know, once I graduated from medical school and then got towards the end of my residency is when I actually joined the team. But prior to that, I had done a lot of years in the world of professional climbing and skiing. I was a professional climbing guide for over a decade, and I was a professional ski patroller for about 4 years prior to going to medical school. And, you know, the longer story is that I, you know, like many people, went from high school to college, although I was not interested in medicine at that time, and then quit college because I really wanted to pursue rock climbing. I was going to college in the Bay Area, and I felt that it was a time in my life in my 20s that I should pursue rock climbing, because I didn't want to show up in my 50s or what have you and have regrets about that. So I quit college, even though I was a good student, and pursued rock climbing and traveled around the United States in a camper for a number of years, really just climbing to the exclusion of almost everything else in my life. That ended me up in Colorado, and I liked Colorado. I liked the Boulder area because it's obviously a very outdoor-oriented community, and there's a good university there, so I always figured I'd go back to school at some point. And so after, you know, 15 years of climbing and skiing and et cetera, I decided to go ahead and finish my bachelor's degree that I'd started. And as I was doing that, I started really thinking about what I might do after my bachelor's degree. And it became evident through my ski patrol work and then ultimately working as a tech, an EMT in the emergency department, that, you know, medicine was a good fit for me. So I finished my bachelor's degree and then, of course, had to do some pre-med stuff and did all of that while I was working as a tech and also still guiding and ski patrolling, and ultimately applied to medical school in Colorado and got in and did my residency here as well. And then the search and rescue thing just was a very natural progression from doing medicine and then also having that really strong background in climbing and skiing and knowing Boulder County pretty well. And then as luck would have it, one of my friends and colleagues who was an emergency physician in Boulder was also at that time the medical director for RMR and suggested that I might be a good fit for taking that role over. And so that seemed great, and I took on that role. And then as I became medical director, it turned out that that wasn't enough. I still had to go through the application process to become a regular member of the rescue group, and that's what I did, and continue to be pretty active in that team. I've been one of the top 10 responders probably for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8, maybe even 10 years.
Wow.
So I go on a lot of missions. It's not just a medical director role. It's really an active field participant, field team leader, you know, do the whole gamut.
Wow. Do you find...
It's a lot of work. It's good work.
Yeah. How do you balance, paying the bills with... the other half that generates the bills. How do you balance those two things?
Well, I just want to be completely clear. There is zero balance in my life when it comes to search and rescue. Like, right now it's kind of all search and rescue all the time. And, part of that's because I've got these other roles in other organizations, the MRA, Mountain Rescue Association, and ICAR, the International Commission on Alpine Rescue. But the balance is that I work part-time, and the balance is that my spouse does similar things to me, also works part-time, and that we don't have kids, and we've paid off our loans to medical school, and we, live, by Boulder standards, we're frugal-ish. We don't have a lot of, too much expensive toys, and in the overall scheme of things, skis and climbing equipment is pretty cheap. Especially on a physician's salary. So the balance is that we live within our means. We work hard when we're at work. We don't work too much because that burns you out and also takes away from lifestyle choices. And then, the work we do with search and rescue fulfills us in many ways. When we still spend time and make time to travel and do things for fun as well. So it's a great life. I've really managed to find a good balance in that respect. But, some of those choices were very deliberate, and, some people end up with expenses that kind of dictate what they have to do. And because I was living in a camper for a bunch of years, I kind of learned how to live like the proverbial dirt bag. If you're a climber, you know what that term means. And,
yeah.
And, once you develop those habits, it's easier to sustain. So it's been a lot of choices along the way. And, some things I've definitely given up and probably will never, never go back and try to. Certainly not going to have kids, but yeah. not a collector of expensive cars and don't have multiple houses and ski resorts and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, does Rocky Mountain Rescue Group scratch the itch of climbing that made you leave school in the first place?
That's a really good question. And, it's a very interesting question, and it sort of makes me think about a lot of different things. I climbed for a long time, and I've been climbing, pretty sure longer than you've been alive, climbing for a long, long time. And, that itch is something that changes over time and changes with life experience for sure. I found it very interesting when I was in medical school and residency how much I still sort of measured my worth in life as a climber. And, because I wasn't climbing during medical school and residency, it was like, how come I feel like I'm not good enough sort of thing. And because I wasn't doing hard routes, it really affects your sense of self-worth. If you're a climber, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But I realized that, doing medicine was a good alternative. And by every measure of society, that was probably just as valuable, if not more so, than being a good climber. So when I got out of my training, and got into the search and rescue, it did help with some of that. but it's not the same. But at the same time, one of the things, one of the downsides of being involved in a search and rescue team or like a ski patrol or some of those other things that you might do, it exposes you to sort of what happens when things go wrong, and it can really affect on a psychological level your sort of involvement with your sport, your involvement with even the terrain you're in. I live in an area, I literally can see a rock climbing area from my bedroom window. And, you know, those places have great memories for me from all my days of climbing and guiding and so on and so forth. But those places can also bring up some kind of less pleasant memories from the missions and rescues I've been on, the psychological impact of that stress, you know, kind of a stress injury idea, can definitely affect how you perform when you go out and do this stuff on your own. So something to think about if you're interested in doing this, just beware that, you know, you might be taking less risks as a rescuer when you're out recreationally climbing. You might be a little more conservative in your choices. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does change your, you know, willingness to stick your neck out, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it makes sense. You know, I guess I wondered, is that something that you found is unique to your role in search and rescue, or have you also experienced that with your role as just an emergency medicine physician?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it just for my role as an ER physician, emergency medicine physician. You know, it does... having worked in the emergency department for quite a while, even before my medical training, I was a tech, you know, you don't really have to have a very good imagination as an emergency physician because you've seen almost every stupid thing that a person could do. and you've also seen, you know, the tragedy and just the unfairness of illness. So if anything, I think it makes you realize that, you know, that whole idea of seize the day, of, you know, really take advantage of your health and your time when you can, when you're not necessarily younger, but when you have the energy and inclination to do things, you know, really seize the moment. I think that's one of the things that working in an emergency department or working in medicine in general, hopefully will make you appreciate, is the gift, the amazing gift and privilege you have as someone who's fairly healthy and can make good choices with their time and not to lose your life in work or, you know, obligation or responsibility at the loss of your own enjoyment of life and your celebration of what any one of us is capable of doing, whether it be climbing, skiing, or, you know, bird watching or cooking a good meal.
I think a lot of our listeners as medical students can definitely relate to that idea, at least. Maybe not in practice right now. It's sometimes hard to strike that balance. But I think, you know, from my limited perspective of medicine so far, I almost feel like a lot of medicine and careers in medicine kind of pull you in the opposite direction of medicine needs to be your passion. And medicine needs to be, you know, what you give all of yourself to. And so I appreciate, you know, your perspective on, you know, kind of a balanced life in terms of how you approach medicine. And so, I mean, from what you've done, you've joined medicine and your passions with outdoors and climbing. So I think that's an awesome perspective.
Yeah, I mean, just like all of you guys who are in it right now, you know, I kind of lost 10 years of my life, right? You do. It's 4 years of medical school and at least that many in residency and then the years prior to getting your prerequisites and such. But, you know, that, to me, you know, a lot of people have asked friends, other docs, you know, would you ever do it again? And, you know, would you do it if you knew what you know now, would you go to medical school? And some people say, no way, don't do it. And I think that's really unfortunate, and I just totally disagree. I mean, I did go a little bit later than a lot of folks, so I did get a chance to, you know, live out that kind of adventurous lifestyle for a while beforehand. But while I think doing well in medical school and residency is important, and it does have to be kind of your total focus at that time. Once you're out, you are out, and you know, you find that position, that job, whether it be in academics or the community, or whether it be in an urban area or a rural area, you know, find that job that allows you to reincorporate the other parts of your life, and they will only enhance your practice. I mean, we've all seen, maybe some of you who are only first and second years, you haven't seen that, but you will see it in your third, fourth year, and in your residency, you'll see the burned out, overworked specialist, or, you know, whatever kind of physician you might want to think about, they're there, and you know, maybe they've lost a little sight of the passion that brought them in the first place, and certainly their, you know, their families and their loved ones and their own personal, you know, interests are probably suffering as a result of that complete and utter devotion to work. So it's a tough one for some people to come out of their training and sort of reawaken some of those outside interests that are really going to make them the complete person. And I'll tell you, you know, people with good outdoor activities, good time on their hands, take advantage of their time off, come back to work energized and way more both respectful and compassionate and willing to listen to their patients. And I think they become better doctors in the long run. It just can be hard sometimes to dig yourself out of that rut, you know, when a lot of things in society are kind of pushing us to, you know, be that doctor who is always taking on extra work or never coming home.
Yeah. I love that. That's great advice. So thank you.
You're welcome. I think it's changing, you know, a little bit, you know, in medicine, a little bit. Slowly. Very slowly.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see.
Very slowly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, bringing it back to, you know, search and rescue and your role as medical director, can you tell us what some of your responsibilities include as the medical director?
Well, as medical director, you know, my responsibilities are fairly similar to what a medical director for an ambulance service would be. We actually are sort of registered in this with the state organizations, kind of the same role I have. The two main obligations are quality assurance, and so I review various cases and make sure that whatever is being done under my license is appropriate, and then also developing, you know, protocols or at least developing guidelines for the members when they're out there so that they can make decisions appropriately, even though I may not be there or they don't have phone or radio contact with, let's say, the emergency department. And so in my case, in my state and in my county, we have what we call our Boulder County Emergency Medical Services Protocols that covers sort of all the fire department medic units, it covers all the ambulance units, and I just say that's going to cover us as well. So I don't necessarily have to be involved in the development of those. And then because of our practice environment, which is, you know, could be hanging off 500 feet off a cliff or up in, you know, 13,000 feet, you know, in a snowstorm, I've worked in certain details of the protocols, either things that we don't have to do under our own, under the EMS protocols, or things that we're allowed to do under my own protocols to give us a little bit of flexibility. And some of those things include, oh, you know, probably one of the more important ones is when to terminate CPR or when not to initiate resuscitation, because in the wilderness it's typically a lost cause. But, you know, giving my teammates that opportunity to either stop sooner or not initiate in the first place if certain criteria are met. And also things like, another good one is I don't really have my non-physician teammates do any kind of fracture reduction or dislocation reduction, but they can always sort of realign extremities to be, you know, in an anatomic position. So that's not exactly the same thing as reduction, but it does allow them to move a little bit different, you know, move a patient a little bit more easily to optimize the packaging. And then we also have spinal motion restriction protocols that really go on the same thing as the Wilderness Medical Society's spinal motion restriction protocols. So they're they're pretty similar to what our EMS protocols are. It seems like this is one case where the pre-hospital is maybe influencing, you know, hospital-based stuff, but we are pretty liberal about not carrying or not applying cervical collars and allowing people to move themselves, even if there's maybe a mechanism of injury for a spinal injury. So that's slowly changing as well. And backboards are kind of completely gone at this point from our county, which is great.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Other parts of the country are not nearly as far along as we are.
Yeah, they're not on board.
They're not on board, no. And sea collars are still, I mean, you know, if you think about what we're doing out in search and rescue, we wander out on the trail, we hike, you know, 45 minutes up a trail, we're carrying everything we got, and you got somebody who, like, slipped and fall, and they, you know, maybe have a badly sprained or broken ankle, you know, and they did tumble and fall. And so often, you know, the fire department, if they beat us, or the ambulance service, they beat us up there. And if it's 45 minutes, they won't. But if it's, you know, 15 minutes, they might. And they'll have slapped that person in a sea collar and, like, holding immobilization. And you're like, you know, we could, if it's some other kind of injury, an arm injury, for instance, or they cut their head or something, we could walk them out. And that just saves so much time and energy, and also puts the rescuers at less risk. You know, carrying somebody out in a litter is a big job, and if you're going more than, you know, a mile or so, you need something like 20 people to do it, where you're not completely trashing your entire team. It's a really hard job. And if you're talking about 5 miles in the high country, and, you know, somebody busted themselves up pretty good, but no reason that they can't walk and no reason to put them in spinal, you know, immobilization, it saves a lot of time and a lot of energy, a lot of effort to walk them out. So that's one of the things, as the medical director and as one of the advanced providers, and similar to our other advanced providers, whether they be PAs or MDs, and even some of our medics, we really work on determining whether they can walk, you know, is almost up there with the ABCs, you know. He's like, can they walk out, and is it appropriate to do so? And try to make that determination before other healthcare providers might show up on scene and try to, you know, make things go haywire.
Yeah, make your day last a little bit longer.
A lot longer. Yeah. I mean, not only is it a lot of work, it's, you know, if it's on tough terrain, it can be quite dangerous to rescuers, you know, sprained ankles and stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Back injuries and things.
Yeah, I spent 8 years in the Army, and picking up a person and moving them is no easy task.
It's incredibly hard.
Even with multiple people.
Yeah.
And I think that's it's kind of hard to get across until you actually try and do it.
Yeah.
make people realize.
Yeah.
What do you think, or I guess in your opinion, do, you know, you call them advanced providers or physicians, because there are wilderness medicine fellowships out there. Do you think that physicians add something to a search and rescue incident?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, number one, I think it's important to understand that search and rescue in the United States, you know, I don't know the exact numbers. The MRA has kept track a little bit. It's not a great, perfect accounting system, but probably somewhere around 85% of all search and rescue missions in the United States performed by volunteers or by teams in the Mountain Rescue Association are, you know, BLS is sufficient. They're not critically injured patients. They're usually extremity injuries that can't walk. That's why they're being called. And then there's somewhere like that 15, maybe 10% where ALS is utilized, and I'd say of that 15%, 80% or more of that ALS is utilized for analgesia, okay? Pain medicines. Give somebody some pain medicines. And so whether that is a critical intervention or not, you could argue, you know, some people say pain, it's the fifth vital sign, et cetera, et cetera. But I would argue that in a pre-hospital setting, or certainly a wilderness setting, you know, analgesia is nice, but it's not necessarily critical. So in that respect, having an advanced provider, a doc or a PA, or even the paramedics are really advanced providers. They're some of the most useful people in the wilderness, honestly. It's helpful in those reasons that we were talking about just a few moments ago was that, can this person walk? And how critical are they? And where I see my input, you know, yes, I can do definitive reductions of shoulder. That can be quite helpful for a team, and it can mean somebody can walk out who might not have been willing to walk before. But I think more importantly is when you get on scene with some of those people that are really sick, really trauma, you know, really bad trauma, really sick medical, I can make that assessment quite a bit easier and with less angst than the, you know, lower level providers. And then I can also understand, because I've been doing search and rescue and I also do helicopter rescue with the National Guard, is that I can understand when, you know, when it's important to upgrade that level of response. So again, I'm not trying to pick on firefighters, but firefighters are not search and rescue specialists, and you know, they'll often like get a helicopter going. And you know, helicopters are dangerous. They fall out of the sky, people die. They're amazing tools. And in Colorado, they're very useful, as they are in most places, but there are definitely limits, both terrain and weather. And so you want to get the right resources in at the right time for the right reasons. And I think a good advanced provider can make, with some experience, can make those decisions quicker and easier and more correctly than some of the basic life support providers or the other folks that are not quite so savvy medically. It's not that I'm going in and, you know, taking somebody's appendix out on the trail or even doing things like intubations on the trail or chest tubes or what have you. It's more recognizing when someone's sick and needs to get out of there, and if carrying them out in a litter is going to be fast enough, or is this something that we might want to try to get a helicopter on. And honestly, helicopters really are only used on those you know, helicopter hoist systems are really only used when people are in a place where a helicopter can't land. And oftentimes in our kind of front country and our flat irons here right out of town, a helicopter isn't usually necessary because we can get them to a landing zone as fast as we can get them to the trailhead where the ambulance is. So, it, you know, it's just understanding all those nuances of patient criticality or severity, plus, you know, the qualities and capabilities of your team, plus, you know, the EMS system, the chain of care kind of thing, and when you really have to ramp it up and when you don't. I think that's one of the biggest roles for a doc or a advanced provider in a search and rescue team.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, there's times when, you know, we have a term like trauma red, yellow, green, kind of, we'll say that over the radio to kind of just communicate sort of generally to the team and to the operations folks what's going on. And I tell you what, you know, if me or one of the other two physicians on our team says trauma red, it's like you suddenly just kick things into high gear. Nobody's talking. Everybody's just working at peak efficiency, and it's really pretty amazing to be part of a team that, you know, okay, this is a real deal. Time to ramp it up. And, you know, our team's is amazing. And the performance that we can provide to our community, especially in those really critical situations, is kind of awe-inspiring.
Yeah. No, they're, you know, I listen to some other podcasts that are search and rescue focused. And I don't think I've heard one, heard an episode of a response from Rocky Mountain Rescue Group yet. I'll have to listen for one. Maybe there's one in El Dorado Canyon that I've listened to, but you know, I think the things that the search and rescue groups do across our country are pretty incredible. And like you said, it's awesome that it's all volunteer and that these people are willing to put their time and themselves in more hazardous situations to help people. So thank you for what you do.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. I get asked about that, and you know, it's like, what do you get out of this? And being part of a team that performs at that level is a huge part of it. And I think the other thing, and I've talked about this with some of the military folks, is that, you know, and I think it's really similar to climbing. When you're performing in that kind of environment with things that really matter to the people you're helping out, you know, you do rise to the occasion, and and it does focus your attention, and you do find, I don't know if it's a zen or the flow state. You can talk about all those things, and I think a lot of sports people talk about that, but I also think it occurs to us in the trauma bay and the emergency department if you're really on it. But it also occurs when you're doing search and rescue, when things are just going just right, and hopefully going just right, and you are completely in the moment, and you're, you know, performing at your best. There's not a lot of things that allow us that privilege of entering that state. And so I guess, you know, that kind of goes back to why I liked climbing and why I like skiing and, you know, and why I like search and rescue, is it just kind of pushes me that extra bit to where I'm really performing to my best. And the emergency department, frankly, that's, you know, it can be that way too. Oftentimes it's just work, but sometimes it's
that's just work.
transformative. Sometimes
just regular old
less
work.
Less and less as you get more used to it. The real sad truth. It's a job.
Well, we're running out of time, but I did want to ask: is there a incident or response that has really shaped you since you've been with Rocky Mountain Rescue Group?
Well, there's a few, and I think the one that shaped me, well, there's a couple I can think of, but one, it was really kind of a mundane thing. It's not a great story, but it did really sort of focus my approach, you know, just kind of recognizing that I'm the dirt doctor and not, you know, I'm not really an emergency physician out there. I'm a dirt doctor, and kind of made me realize that, you know, unlike a lot of sort of wilderness medicine things where the orientation is getting the care out into the field, it made me realize that it's, what we're doing is not really bringing the first aid, bringing the medicine out into the field. We're trying to get the patient out of the field to definitive care. And I remember one where in the Flatirons, which is the great rocks right outside of Boulder where you can see them from town, you know, it was dark. It wasn't terribly cold. The conditions weren't terrible, but it was dark. And some guy had, you know, fallen some distance. It was hard to know exactly how far he'd fallen. And he was laying in the, you know, on an angle, a loose kind of rubbly slope and hard to see, and it was windy and hard to hear, and, you know, just trying to figure out how bad is this guy. You know, the mechanism is there, he could be like near death, but he didn't seem that bad, and you're trying to examine him and you're trying to get a set of vital signs and, you know, kind of make decisions because everybody's asking you, what should we do, should we, you know, get a helicopter, this that and the other thing. And I just kind of remember there for a moment, you know, kind of pausing in my mind whether I did in my activity, I don't remember. It's just like, there is not, pardon my language, a goddamn thing I can do for this guy, you know, if he's got a spleen or a liver lack or, you know, some internal injury, which is what I was kind of concerned about. It's like, there is nothing I can do for this guy. And really kind of just reiterated my focus on, you know, becoming the best technician I can, because speed and efficiency and getting somebody out and getting them to the emergency department is really what's going to save lives. And rarely, you know, there's some exceptions. Rarely is it some intervention that I'm going to do in the field that's going to help somebody. You know, that's really the reality of it. Whether you, it's not as sexy as it sounds. You know, it's just our job is transport. You know, getting them out of there and transporting.
Right. Yeah. You're not about to put them under and cut them open.
No.
But, I mean, yeah.
You might, you know, I've never had to do a needle thoracostomy. You know, I've never had to do, I mean, that's one of the procedures that might be life-saving. I've never had to intubate, although I've been with, I've certainly brought patients down to the flight nurse and let them do rapid sequence intubation. I don't carry rapid sequence intubation. I've certainly put airways in. I've certainly moved airways and things that sort of put oxygen on, and certainly given pain medications. Mm-hmm. And then the other one that, you know, life-saving would be Narcan and epinephrine for allergic reaction. But those happen, but they're not that common. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good job, even if it doesn't pay well.
Or at all.
Or at all. Yeah. It pays, but not in money.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been really my pleasure. And I could talk to you for another 2 hours, I'm sure. But yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for what you do. And thank you for keeping people safe out in the backcountry out there. And what all of Rocky Mountain Rescue's group does is really awesome. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. It's always fun talking to folks about this sort of stuff. Obviously, I love it. And I will pass on those thanks to my team. And we love what we do. And hopefully we'll see you on the trail when you're not in need of our services.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Dr. Sheets.
All right. You take care.